More than 500,000 Americans have succumbed to opioids over the past decade and a half, and over 100 continue to die every day. This leads us to ask, why are Americans so taken by opioids?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1205th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Sasebo who are tuned in to the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, many of us now know someone who has succumbed to opioids, a family member, a friend, an associate. But given how the giant pharmaceutical companies like Purdue push the use of their prescription opioids via the medical community, and how synthetic opioids are flooding the black market via the mails from China, many of us will likely know more than one person who has lost his or her life to opioids. And so those of us who have lost loved ones look for an answer to this overwhelming tsunami of death. But where to find that answer? Who can tell us why? Do government officials have an answer? How about university professors? Or what about our pastors, priests, rabbis, and Wiccans? Most all have offered up their opinion, but none of their opinions seem to answer the big question of why. And so, tiring of all of those noted authorities, we head off to Colorado to ask one who really might know why, because she is a mother and a heroine of heroin. And she is Rory O'Hara, author of Hero Versus Heroin, a Generational Tragedies, Medical Travesties, Political Primacy, and Success Strategies. Rory, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you aboard and glad to be in Colorado today. The beautiful Steamboat Springs, right?
Yeah, it is gorgeous up here. I'm here temporarily visiting my daughter, helping with my grandson.
Uh-huh. Which is what a grandmother's... You know what? You might be the first noted grandmother authority I've had on the Food Chain Radio Show. So I'm especially happy to have you, because who better to provide an insight into this incredible situation we're in than a mother and a grandmother, and especially one that has been through it. So especially happy to have you with us today. First of all, you are an author of a story you probably would rather have not had to write, right?
Yes, indeed. But, you know, it was cathartic, and I learned a whole lot because I just had to know why. What happened to my sons? And why was one able to become a great success after all that, while the other one ended up dying?
So you had two sons.
Yes, two sons, and they both battled addiction. They were addicted to methamphetamines.
Mm-hmm.
They both went to prison, and one comes out and becomes a regional NASCAR champion, America's favorite sport, and the other one moves on to heroin. So what is going on? That was the question.
And he succumbed to the opioids, your second son?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my second son. Whereas the first one just swore everything off and said, I'm going to make good on my life, and was able to. So I looked back at their education, their upbringing, which was rough, which is going to be the rough part of my story, which is in the first part of the book. And then we'll go on to how they ended up where they ended up and how one became successful, and some good success strategies.
Okay, so you're a mother, and you're looking back, and you're turning over all these stones and looking for answers. So
yeah,
as you look back, where did it start?
Well, it started with growing up with a mother who had MS, but we weren't told she had MS. We kids just thought she was crazy. My father turned out learned many years later that he just didn't want to reveal that she had an incurable disease and would never get well. And at that time, it was incurable. Now they are handling it extremely well. I mean, you don't even know that people have MS. They don't even know they have it anymore.
Mm-hmm. But Rory, are you telling us that your son's addiction somehow had something to do with your upbringing?
Well, yeah. My mother was very, very negative. And another piece of that puzzle is my mother's generation was, you know, relegated to the kitchen and to slavery, basically. They were, you know, the madmen said, here's a washer and a dryer and a nice vacuum cleaner. Enjoy yourself. Well, they were pretty much isolated when the kids went off to school. Now, it's not so much anymore, but still there are things going on for women who are isolated and not in the workforce, who want to be in the workforce. And then they have issues like my daughter who has to work and can't take care of her son until, you know, I mean, she needs me here right now.
So there's some kind of emotional conflict going on with you then. And do you think that had a way of transferring itself to your sons?
Absolutely. I was very negative. I grew up hearing complaints about everything, and what's the use of living was probably my mother's worst saying. Yeah.
So that's a tough one in itself.
Well, in my generation, you know, I've talked with girlfriends about this, and they tell me their mothers were pretty crazy, too. You know, that they were pretty, you know, unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact of the matter is, Michael, that when we're unhappy, our brain doesn't function very well. That's a scientific fact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something
probably a physical manifestation of unhappiness in the mind. Bad chemicals or something, right?
So. Yes, yes. And then epigenetics are showing how much we transform our lives with our thoughts.
So you had a daughter and two sons, and your sons are in school. And how did your negativity... What kind of impact did that have on them?
Well, the two boys, I went through a divorce. It was really rough. And so the boys ended up spending the school year with their father. And I didn't even know that one of my sons, my younger son, was on Ritalin by second grade. Now they're putting them on Ritalin in kindergarten, and pretty soon it'll be nursery school.
What is Ritalin? And you know, Rory, we had this conversation before we went on the air here, and I told you how I was I flunked second grade, and the reason I flunked the second grade was because I couldn't sit still.
Exactly.
Olson, sit down. No, I can't sit down. And so the way they dealt with me is they flunked me and I had to do second grade again. And it was so humiliating that I sat there.
That's boring.
Yeah.
That's boring. You're doing low-level clerical work, according to Sir Ken Robinson, an award-winning educator.
But so they don't do that anymore. Nobody flunks anybody anymore for anything. They pass them on. But they do it with this stuff called Ritalin. Now, what is Ritalin?
Yeah, Ritalin is speed, basically. It's a methamphetamine drug. And basically, we're giving this drug to children and saying, you're not normal, and this pill will make you normal so you can sit in the classroom.
But how does speed make a kid sit?
Well, you know, I can't really tell you the science or the biochemistry behind that, but it basically just turns them into a zombie. I mean, they.
Well, from what I've heard, Roy, is that the Ritalin, which is a speed, acts in the reverse on young people.
Right.
So instead of speeding them up, it slows them down.
So. Yeah. So they will sit still. And adapt to an analytic type classroom venue where they don't disturb anybody else. But the problem with kinesthetic learners is they need to be moving in order to absorb information.
Now, let's explain that one for the audience. What is kinesthetic learners? What does that mean?
They are people who are less inclined toward hearing and seeing and more inclined toward doing. They are the hands-on people. They are the people who want to become auto mechanics and do art and music and all of the social, you know, the arts things that have been cut from the schools.
Yeah.
And by the time my second son got into school, 6 years after my first son, they had already cut a lot of those programs. So my book goes into how my older son getting a modicum of kinesthetic learning environments, how that basically saved him, I think.
So you had two sons, 6 years apart. The first one got into school and had the opportunity to move around a little bit and do this and do that and use his body. And 6 years by... Six years later, the second son had to sit at a desk.
Right. Right. And then was given Ritalin and told, you're not normal. Take this pill to be normal. Well, when you grow up with that idea that pills make you normal, what do you want to do your whole life? Let's take more pills to feel better. Let's not learn how to cope. Let's not have an environment that works for me. It doesn't matter anymore. I'll just take pills.
And so how long? They started in the second grade?
Yeah, and now they're starting younger than that. I think they're even starting in kindergarten.
So
pretty soon it will be preschool.
Mm-hmm. So you have these, your sons, was both of your sons subjected to the Ritalin or just one?
Just the one.
Just the
one. My older son had just enough of that kinesthetic learning environment that he could wait it out in the classroom until he could go out and do recess or go to music class or art class or whatever stimulated him in a manual way.
And so the second son would
stick it out.
Yeah, and the second son was subjected to sitting at a desk and take the Ritalin. And of course, you have to take the Ritalin if they tell you to, right?
Yes, and basically, I've spoken to some groups, and I'll never forget this one woman said, yeah, the teacher is the one who's telling the parents and the schools that the kid has to have Ritalin. And, you know, it was like, well, can you talk to them about maybe adding kinesthetic activities to the classroom so that nobody needs Ritalin.
Get him out and about. Well, just thinking back on my poor second grade teacher, I had a lot of sympathy for her to put up with me, who needed to be out and about, but was stuck in a desk. And I'm glad they didn't have Ritalin, and I'm just so grateful. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking with a heroine of heroin. Her name is Rory O'Hara, author of Hero Versus Heroin, and the story of her two sons. One made it through school, the other didn't. Let's talk about how they made that transition. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
It must have been a terror to watch your child come out of school hooked, essentially, on Ritalin. And where do you go when you've spent years and years and years taking Ritalin to be able to sit through class? So you're remarking, Rory O'Hara, that it really wasn't the teacher's fault. Well, whose fault was it that the kids are on Ritalin, if not the teacher's?
Well, you know, it's an unwitting problem that the people in charge of the education system, you know, they were just doing what's been done for 3,000 years in education, is just you sit there you all stand up and go to the bathroom at the same time, and et cetera, et cetera. But you have to sit still for the lessons. But, you know, it's the education system. They need to take on the kinesthetic learning issue and get it across the board. Now, I hear from people all the time that, oh, they know a teacher who does this in her classroom. They put special seats that bounce, and the kids who can't sit still actually sit there and bounce, and they actually learn. And they don't disturb anyone because it's noiseless. And they're in the back where they aren't being seen bouncing around.
And they're actually doing this in public schools?
Well, one teacher that a friend of mine told me about in a public school. Mm-hmm. And so it's the teachers who are actually kind of coming up with remedies. But we need the entire Board of Education to start implementing kinesthetic learning venues that everybody can learn and not be bored out of their mind.
Well, with respect to that, I don't think they're going to make any changes until they really understand the consequences of not making any changes. And if it's true that one of the big reasons that we're suffering the tsunami of heroin and opioid overdoses is that we're training our children essentially to become drug addicts from the get-go.
Exactly. And, you know, I heard this story, or I read this story about a short story about Kurt Cobain. The World Drug Organization tells that story that we're treating kids with speed drugs. And that's what happened to Kurt Cobain, and his wife, Courtney Love, said that he always said it goes back to having taken Ritalin. And that turned on the light for me, you know, that what does a first grader think when they're being given a pill saying you're not normal, you have to take this pill to be normal?
And kids are very impressionable at that age.
My God.
You know, when they held me back from second grade, I thought I was stupid.
Of course.
I thought they were doing it because I was stupid. And it took many years to think otherwise.
See, and that's what environment does to us. It tells us whether everybody thinks you're stupid or smart. And then we take it from there, and we grow up believing it, and that becomes subconscious beliefs that are acted out in the real world. And if you think you're kind of stupid or whatever, then you just are looking for relief all the time. And that relief comes very well in that little package that starts with an H.
There it is.
It ruins people, and it ruins families, and it just, it's tearing up a lot of people. And by the way, one of your statistics, you said 100 Americans every day. There's an organization that says it's 130 Americans are dying every day from opioid overdoses. And it was 116 back in 2016 when I started this book and, you know, got that stat into the book. But now, today it's 130.
So you're watching your sons go through school. One's 6 years older than the other ones, so you see him go through and he does okay. But then the other one, when did you start thinking that something was really going wrong there with the
To tell you the truth, I was on the side of the doctors. You know, something's wrong with him chemically. He needs chemicals to, you know, we grew up with better living through chemistry.
Right.
You remember the ads, Michael.
Sure. They're still there. every night on the television, they're still there.
Oh. Well, I don't watch mainstream television much at all. But, so we're just taught that this is the way to go, and I believed it, and I went along with it. And the thing is that he really balked at taking it. He said it gave him a stomach ache. It didn't work. Well, I found out many years later that he often walked right out the school doors, and I never even knew it. I never even knew about it. And that's because, as I said in the beginning of the show, my ex-husband had the boys for the school year because I couldn't work enough to support those boys, yeah. and there were no deadbeat dad laws.
Mm-hmm. So there you go.
So I decided to let him have them for the school year. I had them in the summer when I could babysit other kids and bring kids into my household to make a living when they were there.
Yeah. Well, you're stating what many consider to be an obvious problem, too, and that is broken families.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And the signal that that gives children as well.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's a lot more help out there now. I see it with my daughter's situation, that there's more affordable housing and food banks and all kinds of ways mm-hmm. that she can make ends meet. I could not in that time.
Well, but with respect to the children, though, you know, you talk about your son being given Ritalin, and, you know, with the notion that there's something wrong with you, kid, you have to take this pill. But there's also a broken family is a way of, it's another sign for a child,
exactly.
too. So when did you get a sense that something was going off the tracks, as it were, with respect to your second son?
Oh, when he was about 9, when he would be visiting me for the summer and the holidays and every other weekend, I started taking him to a therapist at that point. I mean, I could see the writing on the wall that this kid had so many anger issues, and so did my older son, but nothing like my second son.
And you think some of the anger issues were exacerbated by the Ritalin and the speed that he was taking?
Well, I think the expectations, you know, caused him to be completely frustrated out of his mind. He was expected to sit in the classroom, and if he couldn't take it and he got up and left, what did he do all day? God only knows what happened to that kid mm-hmm. out on the streets all day.
There's always lots of things for kids to get into trouble with when they're on the streets all day. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so then you really starting to see problems. When did the kids make the transition then from? And also, there was a physical transition between Ritalin and as a sedative, and Ritalin as a speed.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever figured out where that physiological change takes place in a kid?
I would say high school. You know, my older son, after he got out of prison and was doing parole classes, which really helped him, by the way, and my second son didn't have any parole classes, he confessed to me that he had started doing drugs, you know, by the time he was 12. So I'm not sure that it was speed so much as, you know, probably marijuana to start, maybe cocaine. I do recall him one time. I watched him on his bicycle seat chopping a piece of chalk with a rock. And I was like, God, he can't possibly know what he's doing. I mean, he's just chopping chalk with a rock. He certainly is not thinking of cocaine, is he? Well, it turns out he probably was.
Yeah.
He'd probably seen it, and probably, you know, and he says by the time he was 12, he was doing drugs with adults.
Wow. With adults?
So, yeah, and there's the other problem. I mean, parents have got to be careful about who they're hanging around with. So he was quite overexposed young.
Mm-hmm. And the second child continued, so they became addicted to methamphetamines then, right?
Yeah, and that was as young adults, they were really into it. You know, I mean, stubborn as all get out, could hardly visit them because they were off the wall.
Meth does. It makes you go off the wall.
Yeah, and it makes you want to control everything and be just, you know, I mean, as uptight as it gets.
Yeah. And so, and at what age did they end up in prison?
Let's see. Jack ended up there probably at 26 or so.
Mm-hmm. Young adults?
And then, yeah, and then Ryan followed him a couple years after Jack got out. Ryan went in. And
what kind of crimes did they do?
Well, actually, Jack got caught selling marijuana a block away from a school zone, but the cops were on to him. They knew that he was also selling speed to support his own habit. And he had a business, and, you know, and he the other interesting thing about that is he was running a business, an auto body shop, but he was not cut out to be management. He was cut out to work on cars. So he was not in his correct wheelhouse, so to speak. And so the speed helped him do the desk work at that point.
As it helps everybody do everything, because you're omnipotent and omniscient, all without one little magic drug. And then what happened to Ryan?
Well, he just got into a lot of thieving, I think. And that kind of had him going in and out of local jails. And then finally he got nabbed for something bigger. I don't even know what. But they finally said, that's it. You have to go to prison. Now, Jack was already out and already doing well. He had already changed his life. And I kept thinking, if only Ryan would discover what he's passionate about, because Jack was passionate about race car driving. Plus, he knew he could not. You know, I asked him, I said, well, why don't you start another auto body shop? He said, no, that's not right for me. He figured that out.
Yeah.
He just wanted to work on cars and, you know, do the auto body work.
He wouldn't be the only boy that likes to work on cars, you know.
Yeah.
Guys like that. And that goes back to the kinesthetic or the tactile expression, right, that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Here's a young man that needed to work on cars or build homes or something like that. And there you are.
Jack had the Votech education in high school. Ryan did not.
Uh-huh.
And you know how we always looked at the kids in Votech? Oh, they're not as smart as we are.
I'll tell you what.
That is such BS.
Uh-huh. Well, I remember taking a Votech class, and the job was to make an object. And by the time I was done with the object, I thought, well, I'm not a tactile person, I guess. I have to figure out something else. But at any rate, then your second son, when he got out of prison, he didn't find a place, did he? He didn't find help.
No, yeah, he didn't discover his passion. First of all, he got out, and unlike Jack, he didn't have parole classes because he was living rural with me.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't have enough people to do the classes. And also, Jack went through boot camp before he left prison, and he discovered how strong he really is. Whereas Ryan, you know, he was in prison probably, Ryan was in prison probably, you know, playing cards and, you know, they gamble, they do all kinds of things. Tattoos, you name it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and I think that there's some infiltration, you know, through the people who are in charge of them.
Yeah.
Where there's money to be made, you've got to follow the money.
So, two sons. One of them has been a addict or given speed since in the second grade, and the other not. And when we get back from this quick break, we're going to learn the tragic lesson of what happened to those two kids. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're talking with Rory O'Hara, a mother, and now a grandmother, about what happened to her kids and what lessons might be learned from the opioid epidemic sweeping the nation.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, now it's time for the tough part of the story, which is where you lose a son. What happened, Rory?
Well, you know, as I said, my son Ryan had been living with me in a rural area, didn't have any support going on, didn't have parole classes, never had boot camp, and was kind of a lost soul. And you know, it was a bad economic time, too. Jobs were scarce. So he finally left my home and just started couch surfing. And he did that for 2 years. And, you know, he picked up a girlfriend. She was certainly nice, and I liked her, and she was smart too, but she was addicted.
You know, you brought up something here that is really frightening, and that is the ruralness of the situation. We see a lot of accounts where rural communities are having an especially tough time with this mm-hmm. epidemic. Do you think that played a role as well?
Well, we know about, you know, the rural situation with, I mean, there's a lot of boredom, and there shouldn't be. I mean, these should be, where I live right now, it's all farm kids. These are the nicest families. They are really squared away. They're very polite. They open the door for you at the store. They help you if they see your struggle. I mean, so it's not all rural areas, but there are certainly pockets. And I go into one of those pockets in my book because that's where a lot of the problem was happening at the time I was writing it. And that's Kentucky. So I cite Johan Hari a lot because he's really knowledgeable about this. But, rural areas have their issues, and I don't know really why, because they're in the outdoors.
Well, having looked at the situation from a number of different perspectives, I think what I see out there is that if you are a part of a farm family, you have things to do, and you're very busy all the time. But if you're out in the country and not part of a farm family, and maybe have a job at, a gas station or something, you know, a lot of temptation then. How do you cope with that? That might be part of it. So Ryan was out there in that world. And
in my opinion, I think that because we have a natural propensity, you know, 80% of the average person's thoughts are negative, and that has to do with survival. And we still have this enlarged amygdala in our brain that is our survival, you know, turn-on device. And, you know, we're way too enraged on the road, driving. You know, we are overreactive to things, and it's because of this natural propensity we have for survival, and we get offended easily and so on and so forth. What I think we need, one of the things that I say in my book that we need to start doing in schools, and a lot of schools are doing it, they're using mindfulness. Mm-hmm. John Cabot's system.
Hold on to that for just a moment.
Okay.
And let's back up to what happened to Ryan, and then we'll go to the positive things, that lessons that we've learned here. But what did happen to your second son, Ryan?
Oh, so he was living with a girlfriend who had a son from someone else, and he was just a little boy, you know, 3 years old till he was five, and that's when Ryan died. They were together for 2 years, and they were just not getting by financially. It's hard out there for young people without a college education or only part of a high school education. Now, Ryan did get his GED. He was very smart and could go take the test and pass it. But neither of them had jobs that could sustain a family of three. So that's part of the issue, too, is just living in poverty. Every day is an absolute struggle. Your fight or flight is turned way on because you're looking for a way to survive. And if selling drugs is the way you're going to survive, you're going to do that, just like the people in England, in London, who stole bread and got sent to Australia, you know, or were imprisoned and then sent to Australia. So it's a matter of how you can cope. So he was living with his girlfriend and her son, and they weren't making a sufficient income, I can guarantee you that. And so, of course, you know, it's much easier to get involved with drugs when you might be able to make a little bit of money.
Yep.
Plus, you know, you have no coping mechanisms, so drugs help you cope temporarily until it adds up and you blow up. So that's kind of how his life was near the end. And he would call me, just about at least a couple times a month asking for money. And it got to the point where I would give a credit card number to a pizza person, mm-hmm. you know, pizza store, so that he could have some pizza. So, you know, these kids who just can't adapt to, that's the other thing. You know, how many people are really happy with their work?
Yeah.
The Harris polls say only, 25%.
Yeah. So you lost Ryan.
Yeah. So anyway, one day, we had plans for me to go visit him and his girlfriend, and he and his girlfriend were moving into a house they rented with a yard, which was going to be nice for the little boy and their dog, and he seemed to have pretty steady work as a line cook at a franchise, and I don't know what she was doing, but so they had this lined up, and I was going to come and visit them a week after they moved in. Well, that never happened because he died in a motel room on the bathroom floor, getting ready for work one day. And part of getting ready included shooting up heroin, which I had no idea that was going on. I mean, to me, I was so far removed from that kind of activity that I just didn't get it at all when it happened. It was like, what? You know, I mean, I knew that he did drugs and all this, but I wouldn't have believed that he could do that.
And you track this, really, back to the second grade.
Yes, I went backward. Yeah, I started hearing about kinesthetic learners and realized both my sons were and that I partially am, too. I have a pretty... I'm more dominant for analytical, however, but, you know, I am pretty kinesthetic. I'm pretty mechanical. Mm-hmm. My husband could never do anything. I still fix everything. But, and then I read the short story about, you know, what Courtney Love said about Kurt Cobain. And I thought, yeah, you know, maybe that's probably what it is. He was given, same thing happened to him, Ritalin in second grade, and he ends up overdosing on heroin.
You know, my wife was a teacher at a university, and she worked with a lot of students who were just freshmen, who came to school, and for the first time in their lives, they had to face the fact that they had to take their own medications. And there were a lot of them, so many of them, maybe 50%, 50%, something like that, of these kids were on medications. And what happens when they quit taking the medications?
And
right.
So this is a huge problem.
Well, there's actually a movie on Netflix called Take Your Pills, and it's about millennials taking Adderall and Ritalin to keep up with their occupational demands. But these are kids that probably grew up taking Adderall or Ritalin. Adderall is also a speed drug, much like Ritalin. And they have so many demands to be high achievers if they are in the workforce. I mean, there are people working in the graphic arts industry for, you know, games, on video games. And they're just being worked to death with no overtime, nothing. But they, to have that job, that coveted job that they grew up wanting, they have to take speed to keep up because they're expected to work, you know, 18, 20 hours a day.
So your other son, Jack, who was not subjected to the Ritalin, went through the same, faced many of the same problems your second son, Ryan, did, but somehow pulled himself together.
Yeah.
How did he do that?
Well, first of all, like we talked about, he had some kinesthetic learning environments all through school, and he had vocational technical programs in high school. But then he got out and went into auto body work, and then he ended up owning a shop and ended up in a non-kinesthetic job, which didn't suit him.
Doing the book work, right?
Yeah, managing people and et cetera, you know. So keep up with that when you're just not cut out for it. You can't. We have to have a job that we're passionate about. And that's really what the book leads up to, is discover and live your passion. Because if you don't, you're not going to be happy, and your brain function goes down with that. Mm-hmm. So, Jack... you know, he went to prison, got out, lost everything. I mean, he made a good living. He lost everything, including his girlfriend and her kids that he felt were his kids. But, you know, that's
sure.
That's what happens with broken families. But anyway, and he had the parole classes that taught him how to think positively in a way that worked, obviously. So I started looking into positive thinking. Well, actually, it was serendipitously how I ran into it. I became a passion test facilitator after Ryan died, because I always said, you know, it was because he never discovered and lived his passion. And how can I help the likes of Ryan? And the answer came to me that they need to discover and live their passion. It was all serendipitous. I ran into this passion test facilitator course, did that. And in part of the course, I would tune in to conference calls with people who really know why following your passion works. And one of them was Robert Waldman. And he's written a lot of books. It's all in my book, the citations mm-hmm. and everything.
Well, let me ask you this. We have about a minute left, so 2 minutes left, actually. But looking at the situation, are you hopeful? Or are you looking at this tsunami of opioid deaths?
I'm totally hopeful. It's just we need to get the ground troops, the parents, and the teachers to get the education system to change, to help teach people, young kids, you know, get that positive thinking going young. Overcome that propensity for negative thinking, which I grew up with so mm-hmm. strongly. And get beyond the negative thinking, get into the positive zone, and start believing in yourself. And then discover and live your passion.
Now, do you think Jack your first son is a proponent of that as well?
Absolutely, yeah. That's what saved him. And that's what makes, I mean, he is a happy person now. And he does not have that, you know, that the moodiness. He copes with life so well now. And he's so pleasant to be around. It's unbelievable. People just are very attracted to him. Whereas before, it was really hard to even have a conversation with him, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm. Does he still do drugs?
No, absolutely not. No substances whatsoever. Yeah.
So there is hope, you know?
Absolutely, there is. And that's the thing. That's the point of the book, is there is hope. Look at where the mental health issues are coming from that leads to self-medication.
Okay,
and help children grow up.
There you go. Rory O'Hara, author of Hero versus Heroine, Generational Tragedies, Medical Travesties, Political Primacy, and Success Strategies. Thank you, Rory.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.